Hello, everyone. I'm Suzanne Ross from the online magazine, The Raven Review, and it's my privilege to welcome you today to Islam and Violence, Debunking the Myths with Dr. Asma Afsaruddin, Professor of Islamic Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington. Welcome, Asma. We're delighted you could be with us today.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this conversation is actually the fifth installment of our six-part 2016 election series. This has been an extraordinary election season, to say the least, where superficial conversations have unfortunately elbowed out in-depth discussions, but not here at the Raven Review. If you've missed our past conversations about lessons from Nazi Germany, political violence, racism, and voting Christian values, you can find those recordings at the Raven Review website. I have a feeling that these issues are going to continue to be relevant after November 8th, so I hope you go to those recordings and maybe consider using them as discussion starters with families and friends. I use them with an adult ed group at my church, the one on lessons from Nazi Germany, and it generated a lot of good conversation and soul searching. So I encourage you to make use of those recordings. Now, when it comes to campaign rhetoric about our topic today, fear has certainly crowded out reason. And this conversation with Dr. Afsaruddin offers us a chance to step back from our fears in order to examine commonly held beliefs about the connection between Islam and violence. Maybe there's less to fear than we thought, or maybe we're afraid of the wrong things. It would certainly be good to find out. So I'd like to welcome our listeners to this conversation and let you know that my colleague Adam Erickson is going to be monitoring the chat room and joining the conversation a little bit later. Hi, Adam. We are...
Hi, Asma.
Oh, good. You're there. Good. Please type your questions and comments in the chat room, and Adam will bring them into the conversation. So allow me to offer a brief introduction, Asma, for those who may not be familiar with your work. We'll post a fuller biography when we post the recording. But for now, I just want to point out that your fields of specialization are the religious and political thought of Islam, Quranic hermeneutics, or interpretation of the Quran, hadith, and gender issues. You're the author and or editor of four books, over 50 research articles, book chapters, and encyclopedia entries, and you've lectured widely in U.S., Europe, and the Middle East. And we need to add Australia, too, because that's where you and I actually met when you delivered the Raven Foundation lecture at the Cover Conference in Melbourne.
That's right.
This year. It was funny. Mm-hmm. I live in Illinois. You live in Indiana, and we went to Melbourne mm-hmm. to get to meet each other.
That's globalization, isn't it?
It certainly is. I also want to let people know that you frequently consult with U.S. governmental and private agencies on contemporary Islamic movements, interfaith and gender issues. And again, we are really delighted to have you with us today and that you took time out from your busy schedule to be with us. So I want to jump right in, Asma, into campaign politics with you.
Sure.
Get the big stuff out of the way first. And we're actually going to divide the conversation up into two parts. So we'll do, you and I will talk politics and policy. And then I will hand you over to Adam for a discussion of more theological issues.
Mm-hmm.
So as most people are aware, the Republican presidential candidate, Donald Trump, initially proposed a ban on immigration from Muslim countries, and that caused quite a furor, and he backed away a little bit from it and is now talking about extreme vetting of immigrants from Muslim countries. I believe this the reasoning behind this really has to do with the fear of terrorists and terrorism coming into our borders in the U.S. So I before we discuss politics and policy, Asma, I'm wondering if you would just react to this as, you know, an American Muslim woman hearing this kind of talk. What is your reaction to that?
Right. Well, I remember hearing that remark from Donald Trump, and I remember the rationale that he proposed for advocating such a ban and what he later called extreme vetting. He said he was afraid of immigrants coming into this country who do not share American values, as he put it, and that he was also afraid of violence and terrorism. Well, on the question of American values, as it turns out, I'm wondering how well Donald Trump represents certain basic American values. I mean, frankly speaking, his extreme misogyny. I mean, the kind of remarks that have been unearthed in, you know, in recent weeks about his attitudes towards women, his, you know, frankly, his regarding a woman as, you know, as frankly playthings, right? I mean, I don't want to repeat the very crude and vulgar comments that he made on that tape that was released, but it clearly shows, demonstrates without any doubt that he has very little respect for women and respect for women as human beings with their own dignity and their right to, you know, enter the workforce and be taken seriously as the, you know, the intellectual and professional human beings that they are. One of the values that Trump and his representatives touted in public was that assuming that a number of citizens of Muslim majority societies may not have comparable values on women. And, you know, I would like to take him to task on exactly this point. I'm also dismayed by the rank bigotry that he has, you know, publicly demonstrated. I also don't think bigotry is a foundational American value, and I'm sure many Americans will agree with me on that. So it's obviously an ideological maneuver. It is a political ploy. It is part of the general fear-mongering that Mr. Trump and his supporters, some of his supporters, have engaged in, and therefore not to be taken seriously. Now, for the issue of violence and terrorism, of course, you know, that is, I think, a legitimate concern. But then to assume that the majority of populations in these countries, particularly in the Middle East and the Arab world and the Arab Muslim world, are somehow to be tainted by the broad brush of violence and terrorism is, of course, extremely unfortunate and an unfair depiction. And, you know, some of the more level-headed and saner politicians, of course, have taken issue with Trump's proposed ban on Muslim immigrants. I was very impressed by the fact that people from all over the political spectrum were very critical of this kind of divisive rhetoric, and certainly does not represent the best of American ideals.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, Asma. And I do want to come back to your point about gender issues and values about women when we talk about, I want to talk about Islam and modernity with you. But just to finish this, this type of, as you say, broad brush that connects Muslims with violence and just sort of this gross generalization. How have you been, what have you observed about how that has impacted relationships with Muslim Americans and the rest of America?
Well, I personally don't have anecdotes to share with you that would be, you know, indicative of mass hysteria or bigotry, but I do read accounts of how individual American Muslims have been targeted just because of distinctive religious attire, or how mosques have been targeted for hate crimes. There is an American Muslim organization by the name of the Council on American Islam Relations who monitors incidents of this sort, and they have seen a sharp spike in the number of such hate crimes and incidents targeting specifically American Muslims. What's bizarre about this, at the same time, people like Sikhs have been targeted because Sikh men often wear turbans, and people assume that that must be, a distinctive feature of Muslim attire. People have been targeted because of the color of their skin. Again, this is, a reaction to the kind of rhetoric that is in play on account of Trump's very divisive views that he has expressed in public. I think certain people who harbor such deep, bigotry against American Muslims, but also just people who are perceived to be foreign, non-Americans. We know that, terrible things have also been said about Mexicans. And I'm reminded of the incident of that judge, right? The Mexican-American judge who, in Indiana, who was asked to, or, who had been potentially tapped to lead an inquiry into Trump's university. And Trump came out and said, oh, no, we can't trust Mexicans on this issue, despite the fact that, of course, he's American born. All of this hate mongering rhetoric, I think, has empowered certain people to fall out of the woodwork and take this opportunity to express feelings of rancor and resentment at perceived foreigners, at perceived aliens who supposedly do not fit into the American mainstream.
Yeah, and that's one side of the fear that I have when I hear that rhetoric. And the other side is that it's going to really silence people, and people are going to feel so targeted that they are going to withdraw. I was reading an article about a Muslim family trying to deal with those issues with their daughters. Do they wear hijab? Do they not? Do they pray in public? They've been avoiding praying in public because of these fears. And that's a thing that, and for me personally, just to talk personally, that's upsetting to me, that a nation that is supposedly founded on the values of religious freedom is forcing people to hide their religious expressions.
I totally agree with you. I know certain American Muslim women who are having second thoughts about wearing the hijab, the headscarf, in public, because that just immediately makes them so visible, right, as a Muslim. And I was at a meeting of the American Academy of Religion, I think 2 years ago, and I believe that was in Atlanta, where a American Muslim participant in the conference was verbally assaulted by a guest at the hotel that she was staying at, mainly because she was wearing a hijab, a headscarf, and she was made to feel that, even though she was American-born, she was made to feel that she did not belong in this country. And of course, you're absolutely right, this has huge repercussions for cherished American values of religious freedom and freedom of expression. And this is something that I think we all need to speak up about and be more vocal about challenging. I think this is, in many ways, a teachable moment for many of us. I do engage these questions in my classes, for example, at Indiana University. I'm currently teaching a course on Islam and modernity. And of course, gender is a big part of the discussion that we're carrying out in my class. So these are issues that need to be kept on the front burner, and we have to be frank about engaging and discussing the far-reaching implications of what's going on vis-a-vis the rights of American Muslims to practice their religion in public. The last thing we want to do is to become like France. It actually becomes, religious activity of this kind and religious expression of this kind in public actually becomes criminalized. I don't see us going in that direction, but there's a real fear that if this continues unchallenged, that there will be serious repercussions down the line.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why we want to have a conversation, a public conversation with you about this, because mm-hmm. it really is very difficult in the moment where you're being harassed or verbally abused to go into a big discourse about why you might be mistaken about the relationship between Islam and violence. You can't really have that kind of conversation in the moment.
That's right.
And so, and plus it's not up to each individual Muslim to have to be out there defending their faith. I mean, it's just too much of a burden. So Asma, that's what you and I and Adam are doing today, is trying to dispel some of these misconceptions.
Sure.
So that these reactions, you know, just become less part of the way we interact with each other. I want to maybe start to unpack this relationship between these misunderstandings about Islam and violence by looking at this term that's become very hot, this term radical Islamic terrorism. President Obama and candidate Clinton refused to use the term. Donald Trump is insisting that they're avoiding the issue by not using the term. Can you help us understand just what's going on here in this discussion and what's at stake with this, with the use of this term?
Right. Well, I agree with President Obama's reservations about using this term. He has resolutely refused to use it in public and has, of course, drawn the ire of people like Donald Trump and other more conservative or hawkish Republicans for doing that. And Secretary Clinton also has refused to adopt that term. And their explanation, and again, this is an explanation that I actually do agree with, is that they do not wish to associate Islam as a religion with terrorism. And Islamic as an adjective implies just that, and particularly for people who are not terribly well-informed about the religion. I think Secretary Clinton in one of the debates used the term radical jihadi terrorism, which for me is also very problematic. If you remember from the conference in Melbourne, the cover symposium, that I had actually also questioned the use of jihadi in this context, because whatever else these violent militants are carrying out, they are not carrying out jihad, certainly not as described and developed by classical Muslim scholars and jurists. I personally use the term Islamist terrorism, where Islamist flags their thinking as part of an ideology. It's not part of a religion, a world religion, but it's part of an ideology where religion actually has been instrumentalized for their own particular political motives. So I would prefer that term. I often use just simply radical militants who claim to be adhering to Islamic principles and so forth. Because, you know, when we actually look at some of these perpetrators of terrorist attacks, for example, the people who carried out the 9/11 attacks, it was clear that they were not exactly observant Muslims, right? On the night before the attacks, they actually went to a nightclub where they had new dancers and they were drinking, certainly not the behavior of observant Muslims, or I would say observant Christians for that matter. And also when we look at certain members of ISIS, apparently quite a few members of ISIS are staunch seculars from the former Ba'ath government in Iraq and have absolutely no religious training or any kind of religious, you know, active religious affiliation. So I think absolutely, I think we should be very careful about how we deploy such terminologies, because, you know, they do evoke certain associations in the minds of, you know, the casual listener. And I think we have a responsibility to the public to use these terms very carefully. And therefore, I would actually recommend, advocate that we avoid the term Islamic terrorism. Because of the, you know, the unfortunate connections that it draws between Islam as a religion in itself and violent acts of terrorism.
Right. And unfortunately, this the ISIS group, despite some secular leadership there, is associated, of course, in our minds with this desire to return to the golden days of Islam, you know, this to reinstate a ideal caliphate and so forth. And what that looks like, of course, to those of us watching the news is just horrific in terms of the violence, the, you know, morality police, the abuse of women, beheadings that are in the news and so forth, and just the sheer mistreatment of the communities that they're coming into. It's a lot of violence against fellow Muslims, I suppose, if you want to say fellow in that sense. But yes. What I'm wondering if, you know, because that's so present in our minds, that this, the way ISIS is behaving is Islam. Can you help us understand where does that notion of this very, you know, forced conversions and that sort of thing come from? And is that classical Islam? Is that Islam from the days of the Prophet?
Well, I mean, the easy answer is, of course not. I mean, we should not even entertain such notions. I don't think it's very well known, and I think this is this is highly unfortunate. But over 100 Muslim recognized Muslim scholars and jurists issued a statement condemning the actions of ISIS, and that hardly found any kind of mass publicity, unfortunately, in our own media and the global media. But this is very important. I mean, these scholars took the time to painstakingly demonstrate that these positions of ISIS have absolutely nothing to do with Islam. And in fact, they do have connections with what in Islamic legal literature is called hedaba, terrorism. The act of terrorizing civilian populations, the act of plundering and pillaging and, you know, basically causing mayhem and chaos and confusion. The jurists did have a very clear legal term for that. And this is a highly punishable crime and has absolutely nothing to do with Islamic principles. So ISIS is basically a terrorist group that carries out hedaba.
Mm.
End of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it should have had some impact on the world media. That, you know, these prominent Muslim scholars, intellectuals, and thinkers carefully crafted this document and painstakingly refuted each and every position advanced by ISIS in the name of Islam. And that, therefore, this reflects the consensus of the mainstream Muslim community that ISIS is not to be considered within the pale of Islam, within the fold of Islam. Yeah. I mean, that should have had some, I think, impact, right, on public discourses about who exactly ISIS and who they represent. But unfortunately, it hasn't. And I'm surprised at how many people are not aware of it. But yes, this was a document that was signed on by Muslim scholars from all stripes. So, you know, they had Sunni representatives, Shiite representatives, and from all over the globe, from Muslim majority societies as well as Muslim minority societies.
I've got a bit of a follow-up question on this from Jim Crane from Lake Oswego. Jim says, it is often said that winning the minds and hearts and minds of Muslims is necessary and urgent to defeat ISIS and other terrorist movements. What are the most important relevant issues for Muslims? And as I hear you talking, Asma, I think that one of the important things is to listen. Is to actively listen to all of these Muslims who are denouncing terrorism and who aren't having their voices heard because the media isn't promoting it. But all it takes is a simple Google search of Muslims denounce terrorism, and you get tons of stuff saying, talking about this.
But if, I totally agree.
Yeah, if you have other things, other responses to that, I'd love to know.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, though. I mean, there are so many voices coming from the Muslim world, both the heartlands, but also from the West, denouncing these acts as completely un-Islamic and completely contrary to foundational principles within Islam. But they don't; these voices do not get amplified they simply do not get picked up and be broadcasted abroad as much as the minority militant voices that we hear about all the time. So I think this is a problem that we all have to tackle with. And frankly speaking, I think the media needs to take a much more prominent role in combating these extremely lopsided views. I mean, many of us individually try to write op-ed pieces and try to give talks and lectures in public fora. But, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we really need to have particularly the Western media sign on to this and give prominence to mainstream voices that are speaking out loudly and strongly and frequently. But we just do not hear these voices in the West. And I think, therefore, this misperception persists. And even in the academy, I'm surprised by how many people within the academy, and I would expect my fellow academics to be better informed, how this misperception persists even deep within the bowels of the academy, but certainly out in the general public sphere, that Muslims are simply not doing enough to speak out against militancy in their midst.
That was one of the things that I thought was so interesting at the conference in Melbourne, Asma, how many scholars there that were in the field of religion and theology that really got an education from your lecture.
I'm glad to hear that.
There was a lot of, I had no idea. And I don't know why that is. It is discouraging to me that we think we need to educate Muslims about their own religion.
Yes.
I feel like that's not the issue. The Muslims know they have, it's a religion of peace and mercy. And if you ask any Muslim what's their religion about, that's what they're going to tell you. The problem is with non-Muslims who need to be educated about the abuses, as you're saying, of the religion by these people who are using, who are hijacking, or as you say, for their own purposes, and using it. Why these things are happen the way they do is, I guess, really no point in asking. But we just need to keep trying to counter it with reasoned arguments. And I do kind of want to turn to this question of the compatibility of Islam and modernity, because that's where we start to get questions about treatment of women. And I see there's a question in the chat room about Sharia law, which often comes up as if Muslims have some sort of agenda for redoing our legal system or something. But I'm wondering if you could discuss, because you've written a lot about this, as you say, you're teaching a course in Islam and modernity.
Right.
How do you address this question of whether or not Islam is compatible with modern values of religious tolerance and equality of treatment of women and representative government, those sorts of values?
Well, Suzanne, you gave me the perfect opportunity to put in a plug for my recent book. May I do that?
Please, absolutely.
Okay, well, here is my most recent book, called Contemporary Issues in Islam. Is that coming through?
Move it a little to your left. There you go.
Okay, I'm going the wrong way. All right, so Contemporary Issues in Islam, which was published last year by Edinburgh University Press. And the reason I really wanted to write this book, when Edinburgh University Press approached me and commissioned me to write this monograph, because I thought it would give me the opportunity to deal with exactly the kind of questions that you're posing to me right now. So the table of contents, if I can just quickly read that to you. The first is negotiating the shoals of modernity. Then engaging the Sharia, the second chapter. The third is Islam and politics. The fourth is Islam, gender, and feminist hermeneutics. The fifth is war and peacemaking in the Islamic tradition. Six is American Muslims and the expansion of the Ummah. and 7, religious dialogue, interfaith relations. Because I thought that these were kind of the hot button issues that everyone is concerned with. And I hope I've made a compelling case in the book that there are plenty of resources from within the diverse Islamic tradition. And we have to recognize that the Islamic tradition is hugely diverse. And that is a strength that we can draw upon in the contemporary period to make exactly what you're suggesting, to make a compelling case for religious freedom, women's equal rights, for democratic civil societies, and to make a case for peaceful coexistence of Muslims with non-Muslims. All those resources and all those answers are actually to be found within the internally diverse Islamic tradition, and they can be foregrounded today, especially because in the kind of world that we have inherited today, right, the globalizing world, and it's also an extremely violence-ridden world, that we need to find answers to these questions. And for Muslims, those answers must be drawn from within the Islamic heritage. That will, of course, confer legitimacy on it. And, you know, frankly, I think the task is actually quite simple, but we need our scholars, we need our intellectuals to engage in this task. And I'm happy to report that there are a number of us who are doing exactly the same thing. I think some of these works need to be better known. I think perhaps for too long we have been too comfortable in our ivory tower and not engaged, a larger general audience adequately. That is changing. This book was actually written to be and meant to be accessible for a general audience. So I have tried to avoid as much jargon as possible. And I'm hoping that readers will benefit from this book. And if some of us, some of your audience today, listening in would be encouraged to go out and acquire a copy of this. I would love to hear back from them regarding, potential benefits that they might have, derived from the book or their critiques as well. Yeah. One of the main purposes for writing this book was to start a public conversation exactly of this sort, you know, where we talk about the resources within the Islamic tradition, to exist peacefully and meaningfully in our contemporary world.
Absolutely. It's one of the things I admire very much about your work, Asma, is that you are trying to reach out to general audiences, because it's you know, like you say, you can get talking to your own fellow researchers and scholars, but what you're doing has so much relevance to how we relate to one another and to our political lives together, that it can't just get stuck inside the ivy-covered walls, as they say.
Right. I wonder if
you could just give us, before I turn it over to Adam, just give me one example from the early days of Islam, a resource, for example, that may demonstrate the resources for a tradition of tolerance of other religions.
Right. Well, there is that famous verse from the Quran, from chapter 2, verse 256, right? There is no compulsion in religion. And when we look at the early history of Islam, there were no forced conversions that might have occurred in the later period, but it was also, even in the later period, very infrequent and sporadic, because people were commanded by their most holy book, right? Muslims were commanded by the most holy book. And of course, Muslims believe the Quran is a divine revelation, that the words are coming from God himself. And so there is a divine commandment, no ifs or buts about it, that there is no compulsion in religion and people cannot be forced to accept any religion or belief system against their will. And we find this constantly implemented throughout the early history of Islam. Of course, then people will bring up the whole issue of the conquest, right? I would tend to call those more Arab conquests rather than Islamic conquests. We don't know why the conquest started. We do know that they often started without any prior knowledge of such military campaigns by the early rulers of Islam, the famous four caliphs of Islam. But even having said that, even after these areas were conquered, the populations of these areas remained resolutely Christian until about the 10th century or so. So we're talking about, you know, at least three or four centuries after this conquest took place, where the majority of the population remained Christian, remained non-Muslim. So obviously there was no whole-scale attempt to convert any of these indigenous peoples to Islam. In fact, that would have been absolutely frowned on. And we have many anecdotes, again, preserved in our early sources, where prominent Muslims would scold others for trying to impose Islam in any way, even including on their own spouses and children and neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are beautiful and stories, as you say, full of relevance for the way we conduct ourselves today. Mm-hmm. And I just tell a short anecdote before I turn it over to Adam, in that we Adam and I know a wonderful, educated Muslim gentleman from Iran who we were doing interfaith conversations with, and we were organizing a public conference. And I was asking him to please explain Islam. You know, what are the seven pillars? What are the, you know, seven?
Five.
What are the pillars? And he was very hesitant. And I said, why? Why won't you just explain some of these basic things? He says, but Suzanne, there's no compulsion in Islam. And to even talk about it in a public setting might be construed as me trying to compel people to believe. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my goodness, you're carrying it a little too far. This is just a seminar. But, you know, that's a very serious and well-honored verse in the Quran. And I just wanted to sort of bring in a contemporary example as well. I've been not focused on the chat room, but I am going to switch with Adam now monitor the chat room and let Adam continue the conversation with you, Asma. Thank you. Thank you for what we've done so far.
Well, thank you, Suzanne. It's great conversing with you, as always.
Thanks.
Hi, Asma.
Hi, Adam.
So we've got two questions in the chat room that are kind of questions that I was going to ask anyway. One of them is from Jim, who asked earlier about winning the minds of Muslims. And I took it kind of in the West, and he's wanting to take it more local in the Middle East. And you've done a lot of traveling throughout the world and in the Middle East. And one of the things that I love about your paper is that you talk about Middle Eastern scholars who are doing great work to try to reform this Islam. And I think that's Jim's question. What is being done throughout the world, especially in the Middle East, to do this work?
Well, you know, these are not like well-identified movements and so forth, in the sense that there are individuals working sometimes together, but usually often alone in, you know, in resurrecting certain principles that have been perhaps forgotten over time, in resurrecting history that has been allowed to recede into the background, and demonstrating that, you know, what Fazlur Rahman called, and this is a favorite quote of mine, and demonstrating that we need to make a distinction between what we can call normative Islam and historical Islam. This is Fazlur Rahman's distinction. And by that he meant that there's certain, of course, normative principles within Islam that can never be violated. However, in the actual unfolding of history, people often had to adjust themselves to historical realities and often let some of these principles slide or, you know, become compromised. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that those examples that are not in accordance with foundational Islamic principles are anyway binding on later generations of Muslims, that we should recognize them for what they were, that there were contingent responses to specific historical circumstances, and those contingent responses were not meant to be historically and normatively binding for all generations. I think this is a distinction that quite a few Muslims are unable to make. And they may point to certain practices that that we no longer fit our modern world as being necessary to revive and you know, the response to that would be, well, you know, that is not actually part of the Sharia. And the Sharia, I noticed that there is a question about the Sharia, and I think I can take this opportunity to make a distinction between Sharia and fiqh. And what do I mean by these scary Arabic words? Sharia in Arabic actually means a path. And it often meant a path to the watering hole. So what it is indicating is that this is the font of ethical and legal principles. Sharia is not law. We often hear the term Sharia law. That's actually quite silly. When we refer to law, we're actually referring to fiqh, which is the Arabic word for jurisprudence. So Sharia is actually more of a moral code, and that has been divinely revealed. But as we know, no moral code in itself provides all the answers, right, to life's different situations and exigencies. That moral and ethical code has to be interpreted by human beings through their rational faculties. The result of this human deliberation, the result of this human engagement with God's commandments is fiqh or jurisprudence, right, which means the study of the law. The regulations that are derived through this process of human deliberation are very much there for a human product, and therefore fallible and changeable. So what is the Sharia? The Sharia then is the font of enduring moral and ethical principles, such as there shall be no compulsion in religion, right? So we can map that onto our modern notions of religious freedom, that all human beings have been created equal and they have inherent human dignity and inalienable rights granted to them by God. Somehow that sounds suspiciously familiar, does it not? And I think it tends to be in accordance with some of our enshrined legal principles, right, within the U.S. Constitution. So we're talking about enduring normative principles that are contained in the Sharia, but then we also have fiqh, the body of law that actually emerged over time due to human deliberation, and that is capable of being revisited and is actually being revisited by a number of Muslim ethicists and jurists.
Is that the stuff that we often hear people accusing Sharia of stoning women and genital mutilation? That's all fiqh, not Sharia. That's fiqh.
Well, genital mutilation is actually not even part of fiqh. That's cultural. That's another problem that we need to avoid, that often cultural practices that were deep-seated and not dislodged by Islamic law, and that continued in a number of societies, is then assumed to be part of, again, Islamic law. Genital mutilation is more or less an African practice. By the way, there are African Christians who also practice genital mutilation. That gets left out of these discussions. So it's more of an African cultural practice. You do not see this practice, for example, in South Asia or Southeast Asia and other Muslim majority countries. So I think we need to keep that in mind, that there's often a conflation of religion and culture, and oftentimes we can't tell the distinction between the two. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got about 10 minutes, and I've got a whole page of questions that I want to ask you. You had mentioned jihad earlier,
right.
And there is just a whole lot of perceptions about jihad, and you go through your paper, and we'll link to it in the show notes later when we post this, but can you tell us what is jihad and what isn't jihad?
Okay. Well, jihad first and foremost means struggle or effort or striving. And the word is often then added to the phrase in Arabic, fi sabilillah. So it basically means striving in the path of God. So jihad then refers to any kind of laudable activity that promotes the well-being, not only of the individual, but also the larger society. So anything that promotes, that conduces to the good, is considered to be part of jihad. There's a broad moral imperative in Islam drawn from the Quran that says that one should always promote what is good and forbid or prevent what is wrong. So the effort required to actually implement this principle in one's life is jihad, pure and simple. Now, for most of the time, for individuals, that is it can be a verbal endeavor, it can be a physical endeavor, for example, in struggling to get up first thing in the morning, right? To start one's day and to come to school and get an education or go to work and acquire a living, all of that is part of jihad. the one kind of jihad that we hear about all the time is the military jihad. And that, frankly, is a state activity. It has nothing to do with the individual. In other words, a proper military jihad should be defensive. It should be promulgated in order to ward off an attack by an external aggressor. And such a call to a military jihad can only be issued by a legitimate head of state. Not every Tom, Dick, and Abdullah can do this, right? Which is the case that we see now in the Middle East or the Muslim world in general. So it's only the legitimate head of state who can do that. It has to be defensive. And this may sound familiar to people who are familiar with just war theory, and it's meant to be a last resort. And if you look at the life of the Prophet Muhammad, we see that the military dimension of jihad came very, very late in his career. After 12 years of preaching peacefully about Islam and conveying the message of God, it was only in Medina after the emigration, the hijra, 2 years after the emigration, that finally we find a verse in the Quran that allows Muslims to defend themselves against the persecution that they had encountered at the hands of the pagan Meccans.
This is one of the things that I loved about your paper, is that you say that the earliest connotations of jihad refer to patient forbearance in the face of persecution. Right. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the early Muslim community and this patient forbearance, almost even what we would call nonviolent resistance?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Sure. Sabr or patient forbearance is actually the enduring aspect of jihad. In other words, one is expected to practice this attribute throughout one's life, right? I mean, our patient forbearance can never be terminated in any way, because we need it under all circumstances, right? As we face the vicissitudes of life. And that is the most predominant aspect of jihad that we see, particularly in the Meccan period and the early Medinan period. The Quran counsels Muslims over and over again to show forbearance with those who harshly persecute them, counter evil or harm with good, to set a good example for those who were, in some cases, also violently opposing the preaching of the Quran in Mecca. We're talking about the first 12 years of the Prophet's career, when it was nonviolent, and where the dimension of jihad that we are particularly familiar with is sabr or patient forbearance. It was only after, as I said earlier, after the emigration to Medina, that Muslims received the permission to physically retaliate against their aggressors.
One of my favorite passages in the Quran is this verse that says, good and evil cannot be equal, repel evil with what is better. And context is nonviolence.
That's right. Absolutely.
Better, and your enemy will become as good as a great friend.
That's right.
I mean, it's a very hopeful, nonviolent message found right there within it.
Yes.
But there are also passages that people will point to that talk about violence. And you do a great job in the paper talking about these two and putting them in context. One of them comes from chapter 2, and I'll read it in full and allow you to respond to it, okay?
Sure.
So it starts about verse 190, and it says, fight in God's cause against those who fight you, but do not overstep the limits. God does not love those who overstep the limits. Kill them wherever you encounter them, and drive them out where they drove you out. For persecution is more serious. Do not fight them at the sacred mosque unless they fight you. If they do fight you, kill them. This is what such disbelievers deserve. But if they stop, then God is most forgiving and most merciful. Fight them until there is no more persecution and worship is devoted to God. If they cease hostilities, then there can be no further hostilities except towards aggressors. There's a lot going on in that passage, and people mm-hmm. often want to pick out one verse here and one
That's
verse
right.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just respond to that passage?
Yeah. Well, the most important verse is actually the first one that you quoted, 2190, and that basically conveys, I think, the fundamental message within that cluster of verses is that there can be no aggression in Islam. right? That's, I mean, that's about as clear as it gets. In other words, Muslims under no circumstance can actually initiate a military campaign. I mean, it has to be in response to a prior attack, and it also has to be proportional. You cannot exceed the limits of the aggression that you were subjected to. And, you know, I actually do a detailed survey of this cluster of verses in my earlier book, The Striving in the Path of God, Jihad and Martyrdom in Islamic Thought, which came out in 2013. So I would encourage readers who want to actually understand the full impact of that cluster of verses to consult that book. But the other important point to remember is that these verses were directed only at those pagan Meccans who had attacked Muslims. This was not meant to contain a general commandment when it says, slay them where you find them. But that is only in response to those pagan Meccans who had actually attacked Muslims and had caused them great harm. Of course, as you pointed out, you can pluck this verse out of context and deploy it as a proof text that allows you to go around slaying people. And of course, groups like ISIS and other militants are able to do that. But I think it's important for us to realize that there is a larger context to it. And by no means was this verse meant to be used as kind of a, you know, mandating a scorched earth policy against those assumed to be your enemies.
It's also really interesting because you talk about the history of the interpretation of this. In very early in Islamic history,
yes,
people are saying this is specifically about the first Muslims. This isn't
right
about us. So a mm-hmm lot of people, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, one of my heroes, who led a nonviolent
yes
protest against the British Raj, look at these
right
verses and say, this is not for us to
yes
use or to be violent. It was just for them, and we have to stick with the nonviolent ethic.
Absolutely, yes.
Like, the context is just fascinating to me. The
mm-hmm
different ways in which this has been interpreted throughout Islamic history.
Yeah.
Fascinating. One of the other hot button issues is some people claim that Islam promotes suicide bombings.
Yeah.
Can you talk about suicide bombings and Islam?
Yeah. Well, that's just not true, because the Quran actually categorically forbids suicide, self-immolation in any way. And so does the Hadith literature, the literature that contains the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. So that is categorically forbidden. Life is a gift from God, and we are always supposed to protect it and nurture it for ourselves, but also for our fellow human beings. I mean, that's just a primary moral imperative within Islam, and that simply cannot be violated ever. In the book that I mentioned, The Striving in the Path of God, I actually look at some of the writings of these suicide bombers and try to look at the rationale that they present. They actually present it as more or less a practical military stratagem. They're often saying, oh, we are outnumbered and outgunned by superior military forces. The only thing we can use actually to strike terror in their hearts is our own bodies. And so they justify it on the basis of the practical benefit that can, in their sick thinking, I mean, that can result from this stratagem. But they're not actually able to invoke any kind of Quranic text or any kind of, you know, scriptural basis for this belief. I would recommend reading the detailed refutation that has been posted by a Pakistani cleric, Al-Qadri. And for some reason, I'm blanking out on his first name. But I do refer to that both in that book, The Striving in the Path of God, but also in my Contemporary Issues in Islam. Again, he actually goes through the some of the arguments that have been put forth by those who support the idea of suicide bombing and just absolutely demolishes them, because he proves with beyond doubt that there is absolutely no basis, no scriptural basis for this position, and that is a purely, opportunistic and amoral position that they have adopted, mainly because of their desire to wreak vengeance on those they consider to be their enemies.
Well, Asma, we are coming to the end of our hour,
mm-hmm.
And I thought that I would just end with a really simple question that has no nuance in it whatsoever. And that is, who is God in Islam?
Yes. Well, you know, according to the Quran, God is, his Arabic name is Allah, but don't forget that this Arabic word is actually used also by Arabic speaking Christians and by Arabic speaking Jews. But in the Quran, God.
By Jesus himself, right?
Yeah. That's right. In the Arabic Bible, yes. But God, according to the Quran, is clearly the God who is universal, and he has sent revelations to humankind through, you know, a huge number of prophets and messengers. And of course, within that list of prophets and messengers are included names that will be very familiar to your audience, Moses and Jacob and Solomon and Jesus Christ himself. And of course, then Muhammad is, as Muslims believe, the seal of the prophet. So for Muslims, actually, the answer is very easy. He is the universal God who has sent his message repeatedly to humanity. And that all these other great religions that precede Islam actually are to be recognized as part of God's universal message. You know, different inflections for different societies, but ultimately the bottom line message is one and the same, that, you know, God is one and we are all his servants on earth.
Thank you. Thank you, Asma, for being here with us and for fielding all these questions. I have learned so much. And Jim says this has been a wonderful education for me.
Great.
And a wonderful education for all of us. We could have gone on for another 3 hours, I think. So thank you for being here. It was a great pleasure. And thank you to all of our guests who are here in the chat room and adding to the conversation. I just want everybody to know that next week we will be talking with Hannah Michaela about scapegoating, politics, and how to create a better world. So until then, again, thank you, Asma.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Suzanne. And thanks, everyone, for joining in.
And we will link to all of your books and to the video of your paper when I post this a little later. Until then, everyone, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.